The Guardian.
Hello, I'm Matt Wells. Welcome to a very special edition of Media Talk dedicated to, well, what else? The phone hacking scandal that's rocked the press, the police and Parliament to its very news core.
I would just like to say one sentence. This is the most humble day of my life.
I don't know anyone in their right mind who would authorise, know, sanction, approve of anyone listening to the voicemails of Millie Dowler in those circumstances.
If it turns out Andy Coulson knew about the hacking at the News of the World, he will not only have lied to me, but he would have lied to the police, to a select committee, to the Press Complaints Commission, and, of course, perjured himself in a court of law. More to the point, if that comes to the pass, he could also expect to face severe criminal charges.
We're recording the show in front of a live audience here at The Guardian's King's Place HQ. In the next hour or so, we'll look back on another extraordinary week in which Rupert Murdoch was forced to eat humble pie, James Murdoch denied knowledge of pretty much everything rotten going on at News International, and David Cameron tried once again to shake off the spectre of Andy Coulson. Now, if that wasn't enough to dominate the headlines, two of Murdoch's most senior aides, Les Hinton and Rebecca Brooks, have resigned. The country's two top cops have handed in their notice, and one of the original whistleblowers at the News of the World was found dead in his home. If you were pitching this to a Hollywood studio, they'd tell you it was too far-fetched. So how to make sense of it all? Well, fortunately, we have the main players in the drama as it continues to play out. Alan Rusbridger is The Guardian's editor-in-chief. Nick Davis is our special reporter who's been in the driving seat behind the phone hacking story. Jonathan Friedland is a Guardian columnist. And Jane Martinson is a former editor of Media Guardian. Ladies and gentlemen, your panel. Make it absolutely clear, has everyone been through our rigid security checks? No shaving foam, no paper plates. The only flanneling will be going on, but it will be our panel. I want to start with you, Nick. I mean, it's been an extraordinary story. You were on this podcast a couple of weeks ago, and you were asked if you could imagine how it could have come to this. It's been even more cataclysmic since then. Why has it all happened? Why is it all collapsing so quickly?
It's hard to describe or explain. I would say there's a combination of two things at work, isn't there? One is the sheer emotional power of the Millie Dowler story. And we knew when we published it that it was powerful. And I said to Alan before we ran it, this is the most powerful hacking story so far. But I didn't understand quite how powerful. I never foresaw its destructive force. So you have that, this great emotional spasm. But the other factor that's in there, I think, is the latent anger with the Murdoch organisation. That the parallel I keep thinking of, it's like having a bully in the playground, and everybody's scared of the bully, and nobody quite dares to stand up. And it gets to the point, which has been the case with the Murdoch organisation, that the bully doesn't have to tell people what to do. They spontaneously do what they think will please him and tiptoe around him. But suddenly, there were enough people who were angry because of the Millie Dowler factor that they all started to stand up and saw each other's courage and found their own, and therefore there was enough opposition to defy him. It's something to do with that. It's the latent hostility to Murdoch breaking through.
Alan, did you? Guardian's been pursuing the story for a very long time. It is extraordinary how such an enormous edifice as the Murdoch Empire does seem to be crumbling.
No, I mean, it's amazing. I mean, none of us could have seen this happening. I mean, when Nick and I discussed the Gordon Taylor story, the story of how James Murdoch signed the check in order to conceal this settlement.
This was the first story.
Which showed, so it's back in exactly 2 years ago, in July 2009. The reason they signed such a large check was because it revealed that the loan Apple theory was wrong. We both knew at that point that this was going to end badly for people within News International.
So could have anticipated resignations, perhaps.
Within hours, there was going to be the cover up had started, and within a week, it was obvious that they just weren't going to. So we sort of dug in, and we knew it was going to be a long. But I mean, it had no conception that it was going to end up like this.
Jonathan, you write thrillers in your spare time, don't you? Do you think this? I mean, this has, it's almost like, well, I was going to say, it was not quite like one of your plots. It's so extraordinary. Could you come up with a plot like this?
Well, the truth is I'm actually meant to be writing a thriller under this, my alter ego, Sam Bourne, at the moment, and I've broken away from it because of this story. And the truth is I don't think you would ever dare come up with a storyline like this. You would be accused of just going over the top. This would be excessive. They would say, the editor would say to you, you can have one of the policemen resigning, but you can't have both, because obviously once the top one's got the other, you can have, okay, you can have the chief executive of News International, but you can't have Les Hinton as well. And then in the same day, that's the other thing, your pacing's all wrong. You've got these three resignations in a weekend in that way. And you also have, you know, normally what would happen, I think, if you were constructing this as a novel, you would say, here's a conspiracy which appears to be a conspiracy in the media, in this one big media organisation. And then the big reveal would come, but actually it's not just that, it's also another institution, the police. What's incredible about this story is it seems to be there's a triangle of the media, the Murdoch empire, there's the police, and then there's politics, and the David Cameron number 10 and Andy Coulson. And so that would be seen as, probably the publisher will say, you know, save that for the second book. That's good enough for the sequel. You've done enough for this first story, and we've crammed all this action and drama into 2 weeks. It's very intense.
Well, we'll come to the politics in a bit, but Jane Masterson, you were there, along with Nick, at the select committee hearing this week, which was the kind of, you know, the apex of all of this. And, I mean, that was a moment, wasn't it?
To have
Rupert Murdoch in front of a British...
Well, it started because we were queuing for 4 hours to get into this place. The atmosphere was febrile, wasn't it? I mean, you really felt this sort of great moment. And I think, to Johnny's point, the way that this story is not just about media or the police or politics, but combines all of them, I think means that where for 2 years, all of our rivals, but most people in the street would talk about it being a more media story, you know, only this sort of small little group of really, really people that are obsessed with the media in The Guardian and the BBC. It's so obviously not that story, and I think it's touched everybody, you know, people in the street, everybody, even people actually who say to me, I don't read newspapers, but Rupert Murdoch, this is amazing. And you felt that yesterday. It was an incredible event.
So, I mean, let's start with that then. Let's pick apart a bit what, because that's the, you know, that's been the big story this week. Rupert Murdoch in front of the committee. How did you assess how he did?
Well, I felt slightly differently to lots of other commentators. Sitting in that room, I felt I didn't buy the shtick of him being the sort of wizened old man that had forgotten everything. I mean, he obviously is 80 and he has forgotten quite a lot of stuff. And, you know, can't remember the name of the head of legal that they're now trying to blame for most of what's going on. But I also think that he was sort of actually engaging with the questions. So he was sort of thinking about it and then saying... No, I'm not going to answer that. I don't know.
So you don't think, you know, Team Murdoch, all those people who were coaching him before?
Oh, completely. No, I think he just hadn't listened to that, whereas James had not only listened to them, written it down and then put the little imprint into his mind and was just spewing it out. So he wasn't... It didn't matter what questions you asked, it was sort of prod a button and out would come the answer that he had, earlier prepared. So I felt he wasn't engaging the same way, whereas Rupert at least... was trying to engage. However, his evidence was full of holes. I mean, it was full of holes. You know, I can't really remember why it was. And you know what? It's such a tiny part of my empire. I'm busy with, you know, the rest of the world. It just didn't tally.
Alan, you've been in, you have as well, Nick, in front of these committees. So you've seen it from both sides. What did you make of what Murdoch said? Do you think that it was credible? Did he come across as someone believable, or do you think that in the latter years of his career he has become more and more detached with what was going on, and this all just happened and he didn't know about it?
Well, I thought it was, I mean, the picture you got of this was a tiny little bit of his empire,
1%,
and. But it was incredible to me that all these astonishing things had been going on and nobody had told him anything. I mean, if that is true, then the shareholders ought to get rid of him immediately, because it implies that he's completely lost control of the organisation and that no one's telling him anything. Because if this wasn't on his radar, then the people who were paid to put it on his radar should be out, i.e. his son. he wasn't very impressed. I thought his apology was sincere, but he wasn't very impressive. And James, there were bits of James's evidence that were incredible to me. So, I mean, the bit about the Gordon Taylor settlement, where he
couldn't remember why they'd, you know.
Well, all his sums didn't make sense. You know, why they paid out this enormous sum didn't make sense. And then he tried to pretend that we knew all about this anyway. But the central fact was that this was that this revealed more reporters. It wasn't just Clive Goodman. And then somebody said, "But did you see the crucial emails that Nick revealed to the Commons Committee 2 years ago?" And he said, "No." So why was he signing a cheque for this vast sum of money? So none of that made sense to me.
He was stuck in a cleft stick because the reason that they settled that case with Gordon Taylor was that the judge who was overseeing the suing by Gordon Taylor of the News of the World had ordered the police to disclose any material evidence that they were sitting on. And in amongst what they disclosed was this lethal email sent by a junior reporter to Glenn Mulcair, the private investigator, for the attention of the News of the World's chief reporter, Neville Thirlbeck, and containing 35 transcribed voicemail messages. So that shows you that the News of the World were behind the interception, precisely what they had been denying. So the reason they're settling this case and paying out hundreds of thousands of pounds in costs and damages is because of that piece of evidence. But if he admits that he had that piece of evidence at that time, then he should have handed it to the police, and he should have come back to Parliament and the Press Complaints Commission and the public and said, everything we've told you in the past was untrue. It was ridiculous, just incredible.
Brilliant, completely circular logic. So he said, we got great satisfaction from the fact that we got a clean bill of health from the police and from the PCC. But they had lied to the PCC and the police. So they tell lies to the PCC.
Yeah.
The PCC then come out with this White Rose report, and then they say, "Oh, look, the PCC supported us. That means we must be right." I mean, all this logic will fall apart once they. Yeah. It wasn't very forensic.
No, so I thought this was not a spontaneous event. These are two people who run a global corporation who are very, very scared that great chunks are falling off the corporation. They're in an enormous amount of trouble. And when they came into the room, we were all sitting there nervously waiting for the world's most powerful man to come in. And they suddenly appeared in the corner of the room, these two guys in their grey suits, with these other characters around them. And they're the players here, consiglieri, the advisors. And these are very highly paid lawyers and PR people and consultants and wizards.
Well, there's former assistant secretaries of state.
Okay, and they've been working on this thing for days. They've pulled apart all of the evidence that could trouble them. Okay, what's our line on this? What's our line on that? James, this is your line on this. And Rupert, here's the PR line. This is tomorrow's headline. The most humble day of your life. Say it again, Rupert. The most humble day of your life. Cruel. And it works. That's the headline the next day. These are PR people. They fix the news.
And the pie. So you've got humble pie as well. Genius.
That was an accident. But Rupert says the line, but he never wrote it. It's like when Blair says, "Ah, the people's princess." It's Campbell's line. And he just mouthpieces
that,
it.
That moment when Sanders says, "Have you heard of the phrase willful blindness?" And there was this utterly telling silence because their evidence was so full of holes. And willful blindness, you know, two senior directors went to prison.
It was a revealing moment then, because James Murdoch, who until then had been the sort of corporate graduate who'd swallowed the Harvard Business School manual, you know, and was able to regurgitate it at will, he sort of slightly blanked the phrase. But River Murdoch, who until that moment, you know, they'd had this routine of sort of good cop, doddery cop.
Yeah.
At that moment, River Murdoch showed that he was still sharp as a tack because he zeroed in, he knew the legal significance, and he said, "Absolutely, I know what willful blindness means," and we weren't guilty.
On the record,
of it.
Everyone, you're recording me. We didn't do that.
Yes, and that showed to me
and
that
he was the tone of his voice changed.
Yes,
you know, he wasn't going, "Just a moment, I'm so humble." He literally went, "No, we didn't do that."
And that's why I think the way he acted in the beginning of the hearing, especially under question from Tom Watson, was probably an act, and that was quite striking itself.
Johnny, how did you assess the performance of the MPs themselves? Because this was their big moment, and they were a mixed bunch, weren't they?
You're being very kind. Then let's begin with the positive, and there is a positive, which is that they did it at all, and that they've finally found that they have some strength, and Parliament is actually asserting itself, and they've been doing that throughout this whole incredible fortnight, with Ed Miliband leading and in the Commons, and also bringing together that, the motion that was in the end unanimous. So that's really important to say that. And having the gall to summon Rupert Murdoch, never done it before, 40 years owning media in this country, and they called him before them. That's really positive. I thought Tom Watson's questioning and his whole conduct throughout this whole story deserves huge admiration. He knew that you have to just ask short, precise, focused questions that do not invite speeches, that invite answers. The others, with a couple of exceptions, I thought Louise Mensch was quite sharp, and there was Paul Farrelly as a former journalist was good. But mainly what you felt was lacking was either, and these are two groups of people who normally despised, either lawyers or journalists. You want Paul Farrelly as the exception. You wanted people there who know how to ask a question, which doesn't just enable James Murdoch in particular to run out the clock and just talk, which is what he wanted to
also, do. Also, and people who hopefully know what the answer is, because you
and then follow up. Yes, exactly. And the other thing they didn't do, which they really got to learn to do, is to act as a team. So they've got to say, if you don't get an answer to that, I'll put aside my pre-prepared grandstanding questions and I'll follow up what you did. Yeah. And in the end, you had a situation earlier on in the day where there'd been a huge sort of hint left out by Paul Stevenson, actually, the Met, who'd said a senior official in number 10 told us not to give this briefing. No one in the room said who, which is what any journalist would have.
Alan, the one thing that they did find out, though, was this crucial question of are News International still paying Glenn Mulcair? And they managed to wheedle that out of James Murdoch.
Yeah, well, I mean, there were several moments when I was sort of throwing bananas at the TV screen in sort of frustration. Well, I was eating a banana at the time. So. What was James Murdoch's answer to that?
He said, I was shocked and surprised.
Well, if you'd read The Guardian, we'd been pointing out that the suspicions or which were hardening into fact, the fact that Mulcair was on the payroll. I mean, the whole thing was there is... The person who knows the whole truth of this is Glenn Mulcair. And so probably the most sensible thing for News International to have done in 2009 would be to ring him up and say, look, you know all this, why don't you come in and tell us? But you still had Rebecca Wade stroke Brooks last night saying, there's this awful phrase, we have no visibility on Mulcair. The police are not giving us anything, so we don't know what he's going to say. At the same time, they're paying his legal fees in order to resist the court actions in order to get him
it's
to tell all.
It's more specific than that, Alan, is that in November, the High Court said that Glenn Mulcair must answer questions that were being put by the public figures who were suing. And these are specifically questions about who at the News of the World was organising all this. And Glenn Mulcair is appealing against that, going to the Court of Appeal, paid for by News International, precisely so that he doesn't have to answer the questions. So there was a very specific gagging strategy by News International. And you mustn't fall into believing the PR. News International, from the outset, have had a strategy of absolute denial of anything other than something that is proved beyond doubt in the public domain. And if you prove something, they then move the line back and carry on denying everything else, and they are still doing it. And some of it's very clever. A few months ago, you know, they did a big fanfare and say, OK, we admit liability in all these civil actions where the public figures are suing. That sounds very open. We admit liability. But what that enables them to do is to go out and settle the cases quite cheaply. Instead of having to buy people's silence out of court, they can say, OK, we admit liability. Here's some money. That means your case is settled. That means the court won't hear it anymore. And therefore, crucially, all of the evidence which has been obtained from the police and elsewhere won't come into the public domain. That's why they're settling those cases, to stop the evidence coming out in a trial.
There was another moment towards the end when all the stuff that Nick's been writing over the years, and they're acting as though all this is coming as a total surprise to them.
So the extraordinary thing is, for a news organisation, they don't seem to read the papers much, do they?
Well, they should at least have a cutting service. But when Rebecca Brooks was asked about Jonathan Rees, this man who was up on the Axe murder that we couldn't write about, we couldn't name him because it was in contempt of court, that was the reason we went to David Cameron to say we can't write about this fully at the moment, but there's a man who's on a very violent charge. Cameron's chief of staff didn't think this was worth mentioning. He'd been in prison. He'd had a 7-year sentence for planting cocaine on a woman. Comes straight on back onto the payroll of Coulson's News of the World. And this was put to Rebecca Brooks last night, and she said, "Oh yes, I saw that on Panorama."
when was that? April.
Well, at least
so she's just cruelly avoiding.
And so somebody,
acknowledging the
so this was had been a total secret that no one could possibly have known about this man.
Came up a lot in the parliamentary, in the committee with the Murdochs as well, when they said, "What about Rebecca Brooks and these payments to police?" No, I was totally unaware of that. She had said it in the House of Commons.
Rebecca Brooks's appearance, after all the high drama and farce that came before, was something of a postscript, wasn't it?
I think it had to be an anticlimax after. You can't keep that level of pressure up, I think, for that time. There'd been so much for the Murdochs. And she's obviously improved on her 8-year...
Because she talked about paying police, which is, again, another astonishing thing, is why didn't they call the police when she said that the last time?
But that's what... When that question was put by Tom Watson and Rupert said, "No, I don't know anything about that." And anyway, when she did it, she immediately apologised. And Tom Watson said, "Well, 7 or 8 years later." and they had no idea. Well, they did have an idea, didn't they? I mean, the whole was suggestion that she could say this in a parliamentary committee, and they have no idea.
What about the moment of farce? Because, Jane, you had an absolutely fantastic view.
Well, it was high drama. I don't think it was farce. I mean, Nick and I were sitting about 8 foot away as sort of... There's 13 people in the row. I counted them, and there were 4 rows of people. And Rupert and Wendy Murdoch are in the middle of that row.
She was just behind him.
On the 4th row, a man in a plaid shirt stands up and goes to walk out, as a couple of journalists have done, and it's as if they're going out to file a story. But when he walks past the last row, past Nick and myself, the entire room sort of realised that something was going to happen. And he got to point-blank range to Rupert Murdoch, and suddenly this paper plate and foam appeared, and he lodged it in his face, at which Wendy Murdoch sort of became the story in a slightly... it was incredible. I mean, the whole room erupted, as you can imagine.
But she leapt up.
She leapt up, and actually it was 2 women, I have to say, as the now women's editor of The Guardian. The council, the general counsel for Leeds Corporation, a woman called Janet Nova, I discovered last night, I'd never seen her before, was the one. All these men, all these battalions of expensive advisers, sat gobsmacked. And Janet Nova jumped up and accosted the pie man. And Wendy Murdoch was... Nick said...
Well, this plate of foam came loose and she grabbed it and whipped him round the face a couple of times with it. She was really going for it.
And then she actually went to go round the table to really get
have another
go. And the policeman came to his sort of rescue, really. I mean, she...
Before we began recording, Nick revealed that he had a slightly...
I was going to say that. I thought that was a bit mean.
I'm not sure whether I should have done this, but because this guy walks out, I could see that he was heading for Rupert, so I shouted out, "Careful!" And I don't know whether that was a bad thing to do. But anyway, I thought it really annoyed me, actually. This was a really, really stupid bloke. And, I mean, lawyers, MPs, journalists have spent years trying to get the most powerful man in the world to be accountable. There he is sitting there. And actually the person who was questioning was this MP Louise Mensch. She was very sharp and she was asking good questions. We were coming to a climax. It was important. Yeah. And A, this idiot disrupted the questioning. B, he split all the news coverage the next day so that it becomes silly stuff about pies instead of all the issues. Yeah. And third, within that room, and I think for everybody watching, it tilted all the balance of sympathy in Rupert's direction. He was a victim. Mm. Anyway, I'll stop ranting.
But the result of that, which is really frustrating, is that all the press and the public, obviously, were told to get up and go out.
And that's part of the reason why Rebecca got so little coverage.
Yes.
We were out of the room. We weren't allowed in there anymore.
It was so frustrating.
Yeah.
I want to move on a bit and talk specifically about Parliament and the effect on politics of all of this. I mean, many people have said that there's a Shakespearean quality to all of this, and never mind Banquo, Cameron just can't shake the ghost of Coulson, can he? And Alan, you can't say he wasn't warned, because you warned him.
I guess that's where the story now moves. You know, I mean, it was very interesting watching Cameron trying to explain why he needed Coulson today, what kind of security checks he went through. And, you know, the significance I mean, it just doesn't make sense. You know, there were so many people who warned him, and it was just so obviously a recklessly dangerous choice. So it'd be really interesting to know who warned him, and what's the significance of his clearance, because he didn't have as high clearance as someone like Alistair Campbell. So was that because is there a piece of paper somewhere in Whitehall that said, I don't think you should be doing this, Prime Minister, because that would be damaging? But then I think that recklessness was as evident in the Prime Minister today when he was asked 7 times to say whether he had discussed the B-Sky-B with the deal with in the 26 meetings he had with News International people, and he wouldn't deny it. So we can take it that he did discuss it. So I think this just, you begin to get a sense of recklessness in this Prime Minister. He appoints this man despite the huge political risk of doing so. He knows that everyone is going to be watching him like a hawk on these News International Conservative government links. And yet he goes ahead and he discusses the deal with them. I mean, it's sort of... I mean, you wouldn't put that in one of your books, would you?
Over the top.
I
mean, do you think it's politically... how politically damaging? We know it's politically damaging for David Cameron. How politically damaging is it? Tory bloggers over the weekend openly discussing who might...
Yes, I thought that was very striking, that the first talk of life after Cameron and who are the runners and riders did not come from the sort of Guardianista sphere, but it came from Tory bloggers who began to see that there was a possibility this crisis could be terminal for him. I think there's a difference between damaging and sort of fatal. And so,
We're damaging at the moment.
For it to be fatal, and this is partly, you know, speculative and just imaginary, you'd have to prove somehow that he himself was involved in benefiting from, I'm not suggesting he would do hacking, but he would benefit from illegally acquired information in some way. I think that would be that would destroy him. Anything less than that, if it's just a matter of judgment, that he showed poor judgment in hiring this guy, and there's just more and more the kind of things that Alan's just been referring to, he was warned and he didn't, then it goes to his judgment, and it's shown to be very, the word Alan uses, it was reckless. And that's damaging, and the more it goes on, the more damaging that is for him. But people survive poor judgment. I mean, with Tony Blair, people think that the judgment to go to war in Iraq was wrong, but that wouldn't be enough to force him out. It only would have been if he had somehow prosecuted it dishonestly, hence all the fuss about WMD and the dossier. That's the difference. You can make a terribly bad decision and stay in your job as Prime Minister. It has to have been somehow dishonest and involved, you know, deception. If that's the threshold, he's obviously terrified.
I think we're expressing it wrong. The charge is not bad judgment. The charge is more serious than that. The charge is you hired somebody who was patently unsuitable, not because you have bad judgment, but because above all you understood that if you wanted to gain and keep power, you had to have Murdoch on side. And therefore you had to have Murdoch's man in Downing Street to assist you in this entirely improper and undemocratic alliance with this organisation. So it's about that. It's about that exchange of power with Murdoch. It's allowing Murdoch into government. That's what's wrong. So it isn't bad judgment you failed to assess this man's character accurately. And insofar as Murdoch is now a hugely tainted figure, I think that charge, if we express it in those terms, is really very dangerous. And where you get the detail on that is it's not just about what did he know before he recruited Coulson. It's what then happened. We're beginning to get some kind of insight into the number of meetings, but we still don't know the detail of how policy is being changed and communicated through that nexus that Coulson creates. Does that not make sense?
We're all talking now, Johnny, about how a new politics is required, new relationships between the media and the press, and we've all got to have a much less cosy time of it all. Do you think that will happen?
I'm tempted to say I can't see huge amounts of change, partly just because the last two comparable crises, and actually I don't think they are fully comparable, but, you know, the bankers' crisis, everyone thought that we never again are these people going to be allowed to pay themselves these telephone number bonuses. Surely the whole system is going to have to be changed, and government won't just fall over itself to do whatever the city requires. Well, we didn't get that change. And the MPs' expense scandal, again, we thought there'd be this huge clear-out, and several of the people who named the expense scandal are promptly re-elected in May 2010, and they're just back. So that's what makes me a bit sceptical about it. There'll still be that relationship. I do think what Nick has said is right, though, that particularly about News International, that was seen as wholly, not just legitimate, but the crucial player in British media life. there is a taint there now, and what we can't guess because we're right in it at the moment is how big that is and how enduring that is, that lingers. Just go to the point Nick made, where the argument becomes, how could you have let this person in? You made this bargain with the devil.
That's right.
I don't know what the answer to this is, but would there not be the defence that he would say, and I think this may not resonate with people in the media and certainly not in the sort of Guardian world, but might with the electorate, which is, only now do we know quite how devilish this organisation was because they hacked Millie Dowler. You know, we knew they were very influential and they cut a few corners. They were quite rough and ready, these red tops. We didn't know they were criminal and didn't know they were kind of borderline evil. That would be the defence that a Cameron could make, and that's why I think that's sort of the argument he was running today.
But you see, well, I think there are two different charges against the Murdoch organisation, and that's the least significant one. The fact that their journalists were out there breaking the law is much less significant than that the Murdoch organisation is there to bully governments. It undermines governments, do you see? So this joke that goes around that there's a system where you have one man and one vote, you've probably heard that joke. You have one guy, an Australian, who's become an American. He runs the government. I mean, I'm slightly overstating it, but that's the worry. The abuse of power by that media organisation and by putting the man into Downing Street, that's the problem. And Cameron knows all about that because he's seen preceding governments, certainly from Mrs Thatcher onwards, being pushed around by this political bully.
I think the biggest danger here is, to Nick's point, that if this scandal becomes about the media, and Cameron did it today several times, I thought it was a particularly chilling line where he said, for too long we have put on the back burner press regulation. This is not just about News International, he said. This is about the BBC, The Independent and The Guardian. We should be talking about the relationship between the media and government. And if it now becomes, and I think the real danger here is that lots of people who aren't part of a sort of, you know, a media world might think, well, maybe that's right. Maybe they're all like that. Maybe they're all a bit corrupt. Maybe they just do these bad things, these awful journalists. And that's the huge danger here, because I think if the public doesn't get behind what Nick was just saying, that this was about abuse of power by the most powerful media owner and his links into the heart of government, and this isn't just about press regulation and it isn't just about journalists behaving badly, then I think, to Johnny's point, we will have another banking situation where nothing will change.
Alan, this inquiry has been set up now, and members of the panel have been announced. Judge Leveson is going to head it, and this is what's going to happen. It's going to be a big discussion about media ethics and press regulation, isn't it? And it's going to end. It may even end. Cameron said it wouldn't, but it may even end with some sort of statutory oversight of the press, and would that be a bad thing?
That would be a bad thing, and I don't think that will. I can't believe that will happen. So let's hope not. I had a quick glass of water this afternoon with Harold Evans, who was in the building. I don't know why he was in the building, but there he suddenly was.
He was in the room.
Yeah, I know he was there yesterday, but he suddenly turned up. He was there at the moment when they were all getting the paper ready on the wall, and so I said, "Come and have a quick cup of tea." And I just said, "Tell me your reaction. You know, what do you make of all this?" And he was very emotional. He just said, "I think this is." He said, "This is just such a wonderful moment. It's a wonderful moment in British public life. It's a wonderful moment in journalism because it's going to be the cleansing of journalism." And he said, "What I really love about it is that it has the cleansing of this cleansing moment has been achieved through journalism. It's been achieved through great investigative journalism, and so that's what we now have to fight for. You know, and that's essentially what we've been saying for the last 2 years, that you have to go back to this concept of the public interest, and you have to be sensible. You have to be serious about that, and you can't say that the public interest is about shagging footballers." Because no one's going to believe that any longer. You know, all that phooey about the super injunctions, you know, that, all that hot air which was being got up by the Sun. And we've got to be serious about the public interest, because otherwise the journalism is going to be seriously under threat.
But are you fearful about what may come out of the public inquiry, or do you think it's a good opportunity and actually, you know, we'll get a better system of regulation? We need a better system of regulation.
Well, we do need a better system of regulation, because the Press Complaints Commission has been proved to be not up to the task. Sadly, and you know, again, okay, I'll say we told you so. You know, we can go back and
you're allowed to say that. I think.
Go back and look at the Guardian editorials over the last 2 years. You know, I've again had repeated meetings with the PCC and say, unless you do something about this, it's going to be really bad for the PCC. In fact, it could be completely destructive of the Press Complaints Commission. So I'm afraid the regulatory framework that we have at the moment has been shown not to work. But Jane's exactly right. We don't want to throw out the baby with the bathwater and go back. You know, when you talk about licensing of the press, we haven't had that in this country since the late 17th century. Johnny, you take the long view.
You take the long view.
And B, you know, how on earth, you know, what is Guido Fawkes and what's the Huffington Post? What's a blogger? So, I mean, but I think the state licensing is something we've got to avoid.
But Jane, one of the things that does seem to be happening is that never mind the baby being thrown out with the bathwater, is the kitchen sink that's being thrown in to mix a
brilliantly done.
Although I'm really confused.
To the remit of the inquiry, because Guido Fawkes has been thrown in today, so social media is going to be investigated.
He just sort of said social media and then did anything else. And
but I mean, it could be that everything that anyone is mildly pissed off about gets thrown into the remit of this inquiry and drags on for years.
The dragging on for years and years, I think, is a given. But, I think, to Alan's point, the regulation of the press has failed. I mean, the PCC, you know, absolutely failed to do anything. It isn't self-regulation, actually, and it's a sort of tragedy that it's being seen as an example of self-regulation not working. You know, there was no regulation. It had no powers. It did nothing. But I think it has to look at, we are in a new world now, and the world of social media, how do you regulate a world in which the definition of newspaper, television, the internet, they are now combining in a way that, you know, we've foreseen for years, but it really is happening now. That is interesting. It does mean that judicial inquiry could be enormous, but, you know, that something has to come out of this that means there is a better regulation. And I don't think, you know, it shouldn't be state regulation, but there are models that are better than the one that we currently have. We cannot have a system where, you know, they have no powers and there's a sort of code committee that seem to meet every now and again and say, it's all fine, really.
I think the tougher thing in there, though, is this looking at cross-media ownership. And I don't think that was initially going to be in the terms of reference, as I think Ed Miliband and perhaps Nick Clegg pushed for that. That in a way is a, you know, very clear cut beyond just sort of committees looking at what stories are written. You just say there is a limit how much you can own. Mm-hmm. And other countries, other democracies have that, and partly we've got ourselves, Britain, into this pickle because we didn't, and we allowed one owner, Murdoch, to own this hugely disproportionate share. But I do have the worry, the long grass worry, about this inquiry. Mm-hmm. And it's a worry I have also about how the story plays out, because I think, goes back to the politics a bit, if you're a number 10, the one thing you want this to be is really long and ultimately very kind of anorak story. You want it to become that only a few people can remember all the details of it, and it goes on for months and months and months, because then the heat drains out of it, and that's what it's not been this last 2 weeks.
The one thing that I think really has to be explored is this issue of plurality. And, you know, if one thing is evident now, it's why this B Sky B deal should never have been allowed. And people dismissed this 3 months ago, and they said, this is ridiculous. But I just want to describe the situation that's been revealed. Because how Murdoch has operated is, and he does this in every territory he's in, so he has a posh paper, like the Times or the Wall Street Journal or the Australian, and then he has a really grubby paper, and then he has a broadcasting operation which buys up all the rights, all the sports rights and all the film rights. And so he has this. He has business needs, which are mainly to do with the broadcasting operation, because the newspapers all lose money. And he has this sort of criminal network as well. And then he has the posh paper, which gets him respectability.
So in the United States, it's Fox News, Wall Street Journal, and the New York Post. Yeah, fill in the gaps.
And what that creates is two things. One is there is a fear that, well, it creates two or three things. One is an absolute need to do business with this man, either politically or in business or sporting or movie terms. It creates a fear that if you rub this man up the wrong way or this organization, bad things will happen to you. And then the final bit is that this man has needs. So you have David Cameron who believes it's a bad man to fall out with and that he needs him in order to get elected. And Rupert Murdoch needs a green light to the regulatory mechanism that's going to allow his Sky deal to go through. That's all you need. There's nothing. I've just described the situation. So I'm not saying that's corrupt. And if you had News International people, they would all, each bit of that puzzle would say, no, Rupert Murdoch's never told me to write this editorial. This is all the Guardian conspiracy theory. But the fact that all the facts as I've described are true. And that is, so you don't have to have a conversation. David Cameron, Rupert Murdoch don't have to have a conversation. They both understand what each other needs. And that is the situation that has been built up in this country, in which lots of people were frightened of this organization. And that's why this inquiry needs to look at how we ever prevent that happening again.
Okay. We touched on the situation in America there. I'd like to turn to America for the last part of the show to look at how the week's events have played out there. The storm clouds across the Atlantic are turning darker by the day. I talked to Sarah Ellison, who's the contributing editor at Vanity Fair, one of the few American journalists to have followed the story right from the beginning. I asked her how the Murdoch's turn at the Select Committee had played out in the US.
What's interesting is that in the United States, almost every news channel had turned over all of their coverage in the morning for live coverage of this parliamentary hearing, which is never happened as far as I can remember. And I was hopping into the subway yesterday morning, and the free paper that they handed me as I was walking in had this plastered on the cover. So it's definitely become a story that's very much in people's minds in this country in the way that UK stories just normally don't do.
No, absolutely. And it's very exciting that you should see all our Westminster machinations. How did it go down? I mean, what's been the reaction? The stock price, of course, has gone up, which has been interpreted in different ways.
Well, I think that the stock price went up partly because there was so much build-up to this appearance. No one really knew exactly what to expect. And you have to say that this wasn't the worst outcome that one could have expected. In fact, they came out of it somewhat unscathed because it was a time where being 80 and forgetful came in quite handy. Because from a legal perspective, there was really nothing that they admitted. They certainly didn't admit any knowledge of what was going on. And so I think that shareholders were sort of happy to see and relieved to see that there was no great calamity that happened on the floor of the meeting, other than of course the infamous pie incident. But I think that my interpretation of that is that it was sort of a sigh of relief that there wasn't any worse news that came out. There wasn't any kind of smoking gun that was revealed during that hearing.
So where does it go now then? Is it more of a slow burn, do you think? Because the questions are kind of, there are long-term questions surely over whether James Murdoch can possibly take over the company now, because, you know, fine, he didn't commit any huge snafus in front of the Select Committee, but what he did show, the effect of saying nothing suggests that he's a man not in control of his own company.
Well, I think that the hearing didn't do anything for their future credibility. And I mean, people were joking that before the parliamentary hearing, the question was who knew what when. And the question afterwards was
nobody knew anything anytime.
And so, yeah, of course, it's sort of an embarrassment to say we knew nothing of what was going on at all, and no one felt necessary to tell us that there was this kind of criminal activity. Of course, that's a little incredible, given that James was paying for something when he was paying for the settlements early on in this whole process. I think that, I suppose, it is more of a slow burn. I mean, there's clearly reputational damage that's been done, grave reputational damage. The one thing that is happening here that, of course, everyone is watching in this country is the 9/11 victims and whether or not there's going to be any evidence that emerges about the phones being hacked of 9/11 victims. The families of those victims, their lawyer has been speaking out publicly, and that's just such a nuclear issue in this country that I think if anything would emerge there, it would certainly revive the story, and it would be devastating for Murdoch here. I think at that point you could see his television licenses at risk, and you could see advertisers boycotting. So far, there isn't quite the emotional reaction that in this country that there has been in the UK, because it hasn't hit home quite the way it has there with things like Millie Dowler.
Yeah, and if that did happen, I suppose what you would see is what we're not seeing at the moment, which is any kind of desire amongst the political class to go after Murdoch.
Yeah, you would definitely see people. I mean, 9/11 is political catnip for people here. So you would certainly see more of a political will to go after him if that were the case. What's interesting is that on Fox, on every other network, there is coverage of what this means and whether Murdoch can survive. And on Fox and also in the Wall Street Journal, this has been portrayed largely as Murdoch's enemies coming after him, which is something that for people in the UK must be like watching a rerun, because of course that was the coverage for the past 2 years that now I think has been dropped a bit in the UK now that this so much of what the coverage has been proven true. But in the US now people are sort of recycling that argument that all the attention and all the coverage about Murdoch is unfair, and it's only coming from people like the New York Times and ProPublica. Of course, The Guardian gets thrown in there. But I think that that is definitely, in the Murdoch outlets, the angle of the story.
Sarah Ellison there on the line from New York, contributing editor at Vanity Fair magazine. I want to pick up with you, Johnny Friedland, what she was saying about the 9/11 victims. Do you think, do you get a sense that there is any traction in that? If there was anything to that story, they'd be finished.
Yeah, she used the American expression catnip, but it is sacred, 9/11, and to violate that sort of sanctity around the victims of 9/11 would just turn Murdoch into a collective public enemy number one, a hate figure. And that would be, I think, Fox News would stay outside that, but it would almost be consensual. So it is dynamite, but, it is as yet unproven.
How does it play out in America, Jane? You were The Guardian's business correspondent in New York. 9/11 notwithstanding, what are the corporate pitfalls for News Corporation in America?
Oh, I think, this is the thing they've been most afraid of, isn't it? The reason why, but they had that hideous sort of moment when they weren't going to come in front of the Select Committee, and then they changed their mind 6 hours later. There's real pressure from investors. The share price obviously had taken a battering over the past 10 days, really, once the News of the World closed and they revealed how serious it was. I think there's the real sense of questions being asked about the dynastic ambitions of Rupert Murdoch, who runs a $50 billion company as if it's a family firm. There are independent directors and lots of investors investing pension fund money who feel that perhaps there are questions to be asked. And something like this comes along, it's fine when Murdoch is making lots of money and he founded the company and he made it bigger. And actually, when it all goes wrong, they start going, the corporate governance in this company really doesn't fit.
Let's take some questions. We've got some time. Will you put your hands up? And I'm sure you've all got much better questions than mine were. In the middle, if you just wait for the microphone to come with you, to you, that would be great.
Hi, I'm Julia Hines. I was interested in what Nick said about News of the World wanting to have a placeman within Downing Street. And I wondered whether he had any comments on David Cameron's response today when he was asked about the Daily Mail story about Guto Harry being vetoed by Rebecca Brooks. And he said Rebecca Brooks specifically denied that, and he didn't make any comment himself.
I think this is all part of that wider picture of the Murdoch organisation pushing government around. And this seems to be happening on quite a lot of different levels. So I think what Alan was just talking about 5 minutes ago is where you have media policy, like can the regulator allow us to buy all of B Sky B? They're in there pushing and shoving. Where there are wider issues, like, for example, should we join the euro? Murdoch's voice is louder than any other voice in the country, influencing government policy in a big way. And then on really quite small things, like you hear of direct interventions with prime ministers in government reshuffles. We want this guy in and we want that guy out. that level of interference. And so then the question of whether it should be Gutahari, who's the spokesman, or Andy Coulson, they'll interfere there in order to maintain their influence. I think it's awful that it's gone on. And that's really what the story about it. It isn't about journalists behaving badly. It's about the way the power elite functions. That's what makes it important.
In the middle, you had, that gentleman there. Oh, no, it wasn't a gentleman, it was a lady, sorry. That's so David Dimbleby, isn't it? Yeah. Sorry, gentlemen. Oh, no, the lady in there.
Yeah. That's all right. Good evening. I'm Karuna Kumar. I'm a journalist. My question to you is, to what extent do you think this scandal resonates with the Watergate scandal, considering that Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein themselves sought the approval of the then-executive editor, Bradley? And do you think this would have as profound an effect on the future of British journalism as Watergate did for American journalism?
Alan, do you think it's
better than Watergate?
Well, I'm a Watergate nerd. It's quite true. I mean, that is setting the bar very, very high. You know, is it as big as Watergate? And that obviously toppled the most powerful elected figure in the world. So it sets the bar extremely high.
But Carl Bernstein wrote a piece in Newsweek this week, which was headlined,
saying this is Britain's Watergate. Yes. And in a way, Britain is even to underestimate it, because it is an international media empire, as Nick has been saying. I mean, the parallel, if you're being very sort of literal about it, would be if, as I think I said, sort of hinted at before, that if you could show that Cameron had somehow benefited from illegally gained information, that is, after all, what did for Nixon, and that instead of it being the so-called plumbers in the White House, G. Gordon Liddy and all those people, it was actually News International reporters who were hacking into Labour figures and funneling this information. That's not been even hinted at, let alone proven, but that would make it map onto Watergate. But if you're less literal about it and say, why was Watergate significant? Because it revealed how this particular administration was functioning, but also in a way it said larger things about political power, and things therefore changed. In some ways, then the comparison becomes less sort of hyperbolic, because then in that case you're saying about Rupert Murdoch that the stone has been lifted and people have seen how this operation works, and there will be a desire anyway to do things differently. American journalism really did change afterwards, and I'm just not so sure that British journalism is as ready to change as that.
Stone lifted or curtain pulled back, it was a bit Wizard of Oz, wasn't it, this week, I thought. Right at the back.
You've spoken quite extensively about the implications for the media and the government. But obviously the police are implicated in all this as well, and I was wondering what your opinion on what changes will or won't happen there are.
I know Nick, but I mean, I'll come to you in a second. But Alan, sorry, you've got opinions about this as well. It was extraordinary that this has forced out the two top guys at the Met, and then we learned that the Met press office employs, you know, a quarter of its staff used to work for News International. So there are really big questions there.
That picture I described earlier of what I, you know, what I think is an accurate description of the company's position in this country. I think the other bit that was really disturbing was that I think they felt they had immunity. So they felt they had immunity from the regulator. They felt they had immunity from the police, and they had immunity from other papers. I mean, that's why it was such an extraordinary. They felt untouchable, I think, and the more the behaviour of the police. And as Matt was saying, that, you know, the fact that nearly a quarter of the press bureau is employed by ex-NI people, all these dinners between Sir Paul Stevenson and Neil Wallace, and it's the same thing. It's all these social contacts and dinners that is mirrored in Parliament.
And the police came and visited you, and
yeah, they came. You know, Paul Stevenson came and saw me and tried to warn me off Nick. And then, I mean, actually, to do Paul Stevenson's credit, in his evidence yesterday, he said, I went to see the Guardian, and he said, it's perfectly true, I did try and discredit Nick Davis's reporting, and Alan Rusbridge had disregarded what I said. And then I complained, and I suggested that he talk to John Yates, and John Yates came in and slagged Nick off and said that he was mad and that it was all conspiracy theory, it was all inaccurate. And Paul Stevenson, to his credit, said, and thank God the Guardian did disregard what I said, because they got to the truth of this, and we ought to be thankful for them. So, you know, But as a mirror up to what the police were doing, you know, it is a mystery to me why they behaved in the way that they did. And I think they will have a sober reckoning. Though we think, don't we, that the current inquiry is a thorough one. The current inquiry.
The new inquiry that was set up in January, I would say, is thorough and honest and aggressive in a good sense. But the role of the police in this is it's the same shape as the role of government, that they're confronted with this extremely powerful organisation and they say to themselves, we can't do our job properly unless we accommodate this Murdoch organisation. And the vivid example of that is that when they start investigating the phone hacking that's reported by Buckingham Palace, within 4 or 5 months, they came across evidence that this was involved a vast number of offences against a massive number of celebrities. And then they made a decision to put it away, not to investigate it. And they say, and I think they're probably telling the truth, well, part of our thinking was that we had more important jobs to do. There was this plot to blow up aeroplanes over the Atlantic, and the same officers who were working on that were being diverted into this.
We needed terrorism people. Yeah.
But so there was a question of resources. But beyond that, senior officers who were there in Scotland Yard at the time say there was a conscious and deliberate decision to back off that inquiry because they didn't want to get into trouble with this very powerful organisation, which means that they were allowed to break the law and the police weren't going to enforce it against them. So that's central to this picture. Very worrying.
Before we go, I hinted at the start that this is a Hollywood blockbuster in the making. I suppose we should have a quick run around the cast list for hacking the movie. If he wasn't dead,
I'd say
Paul Newman for Nick Davis.
But
I said if he wasn't dead. Or John Slattery, you know, the Silver Fox from Mad Men. I think that would be quite good. Jane, who are your
top? I'm not going to say who, I think, for the people who might be in it, obviously, here. Although I do think for the Murdochs, you know, they have the Star Wars fetish with the huge Darth Vader outside James's office.
I didn't know that.
Oh, you do know that? There's been lots of interviews written by me. But I love the idea of whoever played the Emperor Palpatine being Rupert and sort of, you know, appearing in the Senate like a sort of nice, shiny Senate. And then with the dark hood, he becomes a wizened old crone. And then Mark Hamill, the sort of Luke Skywalker, who now looks quite sort of seedy, could be James. It's just perfect.
Johnny?
Alan's looking completely confused.
Others, of course, who don't fear for their jobs have described that Daniel Radcliffe as the natural valet. I, of course, wouldn't offer that one. I think Jack Black is surely a natural for Tom Watson, MP.
Yes.
I think I like that idea. I think Danny DeVito for John Bercow as Speaker. I think there's, you know, you can... And then, well, this is not original at all, but... It's a bit of sort of, it's quite avant-garde casting, cross-gender casting. So Rebecca Brooks has to be Mick Hucknall.
Oh, yes.
Very obvious.
I thought Joaquin for Glenn Mulcair or something.
Yes. Philip Seymour Hoffman for Glenn Mulcair.
Mm-hmm.
Yes? Who do you think should play you, Alan, really?
I'm not going to play this game. I was so wounded earlier in the week. There was a headline that popped up on Google Alerts that asked the question, is Alan Rusbridger the new Ben Bradley? And that's, you know, who could object to that question? So I started reading it, and it went down, and it said that the thing is he's completely atypical in casting terms, because whereas Ben Bradley was played by Jason Robards, he said Alan Rusbridger looks like Harry Potter's lonely uncle. Harry Potter, but his lonely uncle. Paedophiles.
Thank you very much. Enormous thanks to everyone on the panel. Alan Rusbridger, Nick Davis, Jonathan Friedland and Jay Martinson. Thank you. Thank you very much to you, all of you, for coming and being part of our audience. Keep up to date with everything about this story on guardian.co.uk. And you might like to buy a copy of the paper as well. Media Talk is produced by Ben Green, and I'm Matt Wells.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.